Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Thank you for joining us today and welcome. This is an hour devoted to learning something more, not just about the world we live in, but about how, what, and why we think and believe as we do. An hour for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room, as you know by now, is open. It generally opens maybe even 5 minutes before the show, and my partner Ravinder awaits you there now. You can log on by going to eldontaylor.com/chat. So Ravinder, say hello to the folks and let us all know what's happening in your chat room today.
Oh, well, hello, everyone. Of course, the chat room is just a hive of activity. So you have to come join me and come check it out for yourself. That is eldontaylor.com/chat. Don't forget the /chat. Come on in. Come say hi. Enjoy a cup of tea with us. See you there.
Cup of tea. We have virtual tea in the chat room?
We have virtual everything.
Okay. All right. Caution on the everything.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
All right. Every week I read some of your letters as our way of respecting the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week, our show featured Dr. Rupert Sheldrake and his book, Setting Science Free. Michael wrote, I just listened to your show with Dr. Sheldrake. I have to tell you that this show embodies the name of your show, Provocative Enlightenment. I have always felt that both science and religion have done a tremendous injustice by giving us, at times, intractable positions like Darwinism versus creationism, when in reality both may be correct to a degree and both may be wrong. The Big Bang is just a theory that has yet to be proven, and clearly there is a creative design or mind of the physical world in which we live. To contemplate intelligence with the sun itself or the universe is certainly provocative. I have always wondered why scientists have said nothing can travel faster than light. There is arrogance in the scientific community that suggests we know much more than we really do, and to start conversations that challenges all the so-called constants is indeed provocative. You are a wonderful author and a terrific talk show host. Unfortunately, you need a three-hour show. 1 hour never cuts it with your topics. Outstanding radio. Well, thank you, Michael. I'm genuinely honored by your words and grateful for your thoughtful remarks. I found it very, very interesting that the day after Dr. Sheldrake was on the show, Discovery posted a piece based on some new Hubble research that essentially said, you know, this concept of dark energy, it would appear that it's more a contrived explanation for an accelerating, expanding universe than it is anything else. And, of course, that was one of the issues that Dr. Sheldrake took up, the idea that we just add in black matter or dark matter, I should say, in order to make the equations balance. Very interesting. Lots of letters on Sheldrake's show. Gwyneth wrote, great show. I am going to the library to get Dr. Sheldrake's book. Mark wrote, Eldon, your show today, Science Set Free with Rupert Sheldrake, was one of my favorites. I'll definitely have to pick up his book and read about the 10 dogmas of science. Lisa wrote, I love your Hay House program. Elaine wrote, I'm reading I Believe and Mind Programming, also Self-Hypnosis by you, and I have not been disappointed one iota. I will as well backtrack to the books and programs that I know will help me to help myself as I expand more and more. Dare to Know is a personal philosophy. Thank you, Eldon. I think it is adequate in the power of thankfulness to say you are doing a great service. More than adequate. Thank you, Elaine. Pamela wrote, just about finished reading your book, I Believe. It is one of the best self-help, self-actualization books I have ever read. Well, thank you, Pamela. I like the book. It's one of my favorites. Carlos wrote, I just started using your technology and seeing great changes. I would like to share that a few days ago my work was published in a well-known newspaper advertising my animated film. Prior to me using your technology, I would keep hitting a wall, but now it seems that things are starting to appear in a very positive way. The best part of it all is that I have learned from you that I am the genie of my own life. So thank you. I like that, you know. That you know where that comes from, don't you? You know very well because we have the revised version that we are working on right this minute, huh?
That's correct.
with 5 additional chapters, huh?
That's top secret. Can't talk about it yet.
All right. Forget I said anything. Susan wrote, regarding our free MP3 programs, I love listening to your radio show on Hay House. Thank you for your kind offering of these complimentary downloads. Much love and gratitude. Irene wrote, I love reading your enlightening comments. They have been so helpful to me. I am so happy to have discovered you on the internet. You are a big influence on my life. Now, Irene is addressing comments I make on my Facebook page. So why not come join me on Facebook as well? Mabel wrote, I'm a new listener to your Hay House radio show, but I've been able to download past shows, and I have to say that your work is helping many. I found your guests very informative and interesting. Even though I can't listen live due to being at work at the time of the show, I enjoy very much the archive downloads. Well, thank you, Mabel. And if any of you happen to miss the live show, remember, it is broadcast several times during the week and then the archives thereafter. All right. That's all the time we have for letters today, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to eldon@eldontaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming. And once again, I both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now to today's show, The Fortean Phenomena with Micah Hanks. Now, the Fortean Phenomena are a field of study named for the pioneering researcher of all things strange. Indeed, strange but naturally occurring phenomena that science cannot yet define or explain. The name comes from the work of Charles Hoey Fort, who was a writer and a researcher into anomalous phenomena. Quoting from Wiki, examples of the odd phenomena in Fort's books include many of what are variously referred to as occult, supernatural, and paranormal. Reported events include teleportation, a term Fort is generally credited with coining, poltergeist events, falls of frogs, fishes, inorganic materials of an amazing range, unaccountable noises and explosions, spontaneous fires, levitation, ball lightning, a term explicitly used by Fort, unidentified flying objects, unexplained disappearances, giant wheels of light in the oceans, and animals found outside their normal ranges. He offered many reports of out-of-place artifacts, strange items found in unlikely locations. He also was perhaps the first person to explain strange human appearances and disappearances by the hypothesis of alien abduction, and was an early proponent of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, specifically suggesting that strange lights or objects sighted in the skies might be alien spacecraft. Fort also wrote about the interconnectedness of nature and synchronicities. His book seemed to center around the idea that everything is connected and that strange coincidences happen for a reason. Enter Micah Hanks, who is a Fortean researcher, a full-time journalist, radio personality, author, and investigator of the unexplained. Hanks' exposure to Fort's work, as well as the later writings of personalities such as zoologist Ivan T. Sanderson, cosmologist Carl Sagan, and several others, helped establish an open-minded but inherently skeptical approach to studying the unexplained, which Hanks maintains and continues to cultivate today. Throughout his many years studying the world's mysteries, Hanks has visited a number of places collecting information about not only aliens and UFOs, but also cultural data, folklore, and reports of strange creatures like Sasquatch. From steep mountain passes in remote parts of Montana, his copy reads, to the rolling valleys where Ohio's grass man is said to trudge, Hanks has made a lifestyle of pursuing mysteries, often right to their source. He has also spent a number of years working with various scientists, historians, and film crews attempting to solve the mystery of the Brown Mountain Lights. These strange ghost lights present an atmospheric phenomenon specific to Western North Carolina. His interest in the region and its many mysteries, as well as his ever-evolving methods of inquiry pertaining to the UFO phenomenon at large, remain underway, and today's show will feature his newest work, The UFO Singularity. No promises, however, that I won't ask you about some of the other things. So let's get the man in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Mr. Micah Hanks.
Eldon, thank you so much. What an introduction. I only hope that today I can live up to half of that, okay?
Well, you know, now I've listened to you with George Nuri, and I know that you can live up to all of it, all right?
We'll see.
I'm going to start
goes.
You right out with, you know, the $64,000 question. We
sure.
get this one laid down right in the beginning. I want first to establish a straight answer from you based on your research, and that is simply, are aliens visiting Earth, and if so, what's their intent?
Oh, gosh. I'm supposed to give a simple, straight answer, huh? I'll be as simple and straight as I can possibly be to answer that question. I have never seen scientific evidence that conclusively determines that extraterrestrials are visiting Earth, or at very least that they are behind the majority of UFO phenomena that we witness out there. Because UFO can mean a lot of different things. It could mean, for instance, some sort of a strange space-time anomaly, a physics aberration, or something that occurs outside the known laws of physics, which we're still learning about every day, ever-expanding, just as I refer to my own body of research. And then, of course, there's always the potential that there are, and I think this is the strongest potential, Eldon, I think that we're dealing with a lot of technologies that many of them are nascent, clandestine innovations that are occurring either in government or even outside government as a result of earthbound technology. So now, somewhere, does extraterrestrial life fit into that equation? Very likely, I think. I am certainly a proponent of the notion that extraterrestrials exist somewhere out there. I couldn't tell you if they're visiting Earth, but perhaps, at very least, some UFO phenomenon could point us in that direction.
Okay, you know, this is straightforward. I like that answer. Let me ask you this, though, before we get right into your book. Have you ever seen a UFO, of whatever source it might be?
Yeah, by definition, I've certainly seen unidentified flying objects. Now,
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I've never seen what I would say was maybe a clearly technologically controlled mechanical craft. Usually these things I've seen have been strange lights in the sky.
Okay, all right. That's what I was going to qualify on. All right.
Sure.
So, you know, let's go this way. What do you say to those who insist that ufology has been shunned by traditional science?
If someone says that ufology has been shunned by traditional science, I would say you're correct. And the reason why is because, in large part thanks to what the Air Force was trying to do with Project Blue Book back in the 1960s and then was handed over to the Colorado UFO Project that was overseen by Ed Condon and his associate professors and researchers who were involved with what became known as the Condon Committee. Basically, it was determined that there was no scientific merit, or rather, I should say, that there was no intellectual gains that could be incurred from the scientific study of UFOs. And so essentially, for the last several decades, that subject, ufology, has been kind of, cast aside because scientists say that there's very little proof constituting extraterrestrial life in the equation. Now, my question is, okay, let's go ahead and remove the potential that UFOs are piloted by alien beings from another world. Does that remove the possibility that these craft are still intelligently controlled and that they are absolutely a very real and valid phenomenon? And furthermore, that very interestingly, these things have been occurring since at very least the tail end of the Second World War. And, of course, we have the reports of the Foo Fighters that occurred during the Second World War. There are some anecdotal reports of such things as lights in the sky, flying saucers, egg-shaped flying craft that report or hail back to the years prior to even the First World War. And we don't seem to have any kind of a technological presence that could have, at those early instances, could have accounted for these kinds of things. We see that as a result of that, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and other intelligence organizations here in the United States, and certainly those abroad elsewhere in the world, they've also looked into the UFO enigma with great interest at various times. So my question to anyone who would say that there is no merit to the scientific study of UFOs would be this, quite simply: if governments of the world have taken interest in it at various times, and as many propose, they may even be hiding certain information from the public, then tell me, if world governments find it interesting and of merit for study, then why wouldn't the greater scientific community? Why does there have to be a dichotomy about that? Why do we have to disclude entirely from the equation UFOs, even if we are to suppose that there's no credible evidence for extraterrestrials, which I think in some instances there very well may be?
Okay, now, that's a great answer, but it also opens a Pandora's box when it comes to how I interpret it. James Olberg has said the criticisms of ufology allegedly have to do with how you refuse, or how ufologists refuse, not you, to play by the rules of scientific thought, demanding instead special exemptions from time-tested procedures of data verification, theory testing, and the burden of proof. So they essentially say, look, the fact that I can't prove there is one, but everybody reports it, gives rise to what you just suggested, an anomaly that needs to be proven. Now, there are people like, I'm sure you know, Dr. Stephen Greer, who has been on this show, that claim that they have seen aliens, communicated with aliens themselves. Are we to say that, look, we know that governments of the world test all kinds of flying equipment. Are we to say that it is more likely that it is visitation from outside this plane, whether that be a time situation, something we'll get into in a minute, another dimension or space itself, or that it's more likely that it is clandestine operations going on by an intelligence community of some government here on this plane? Your opinion?
My opinion is really that I don't see why we couldn't say it could be all those kind of things. With regard to Dr. Stephen Greer, you know, he's done a lot of great work for the disclosure movement, but I see that there's, you know, his attitude is a funny one, because he brings forth this very serious, compelling argument about why government needs to disclose information about UFOs, and then he claims to, of course, be in direct contact with extraterrestrials himself, takes groups out and shows them how they can do this too. And he puts videos up during his presentations, which I've attended his lectures in the past myself. A lot of the time in the videos he puts up, I've seen a very lacking presentation in terms of compelling evidence for the quote-unquote encounters that he has had and captured on film being or related to in any way, anything, in any way, shape, and form, extraterrestrial. Now, that's not to say that Dr. Greer is just completely in the wrong. I don't think, however, despite the fact that he has letters after his name and I do not, I don't think that Dr. Greer is perhaps the be-all, end-all authority on UFOs. And frankly, I find a lot of his methodology pseudoscientific. I would agree with Olberg in the fact that it's funny that we have people who call themselves ufologists and that they are the very ones that have to have these necessary exclusions and exemptions. In my book, Eldon, The UFO Singularity, I try to approach this far more scientifically. I do get into a lot of speculation, but rather than citing a lot of sources that are ufological in nature, you know, talking about the Roswell wreckage, talking about, you know, the abduction of such and such in whatever year, you know, I do cite a lot of scientific and technological journals and look at this from the approach that we have trends observable today, backed up by hard science and by technological applications that are growing and expanding literally by the day, and that the trends that we can observe about these point us in a logical direction toward understanding better not only what technological implications we will have to deal with and reconcile with and utilize tomorrow, but also how those things may change the way we perceive phenomenon like ufology and like UFOs. So I would say that, you know, certainly there's merit to ufology. And I also agree by the same token that the ufologists need to be able to play by the rules. I've tried my very best to do that with the UFO singularity. I guess we'll find out in a moment if I did or not, huh?
You know, I like your book. Let's get that stated. And I like your approach, and I love how you have fleshed this argument out. So let's jump into your book, all right? You state that past unexplained phenomena are changing our future. Okay? What do you mean by that? How, I mean, what has that got to do with, I mean, how did you come to that conclusion and you know, flesh that out to me?
Well, again, here's the issue with UFOs. And when I have a title of a book like The UFO Singularity, singularity is kind of a, you know, it's an anomalous term in itself. A lot of people ask me during interviews, literally, just tell us what you mean by singularity. There are a couple of different meanings and how we tie past phenomenon in with technology to the future. And I'm going to try and tie it all together in just a few moments here for you. Singularity can mean a lot of things, but there are two primary meanings with UFO singularity. One is the implication of what we look at to the future as being an event, a period that we will refer to as technological singularity, which defined concisely has to do with the technological creation of intelligence that exceeds natural levels of human intelligence. This could be achieved in two ways primarily, through artificial intelligence that we create, or by supplementing natural levels of human intelligence with technologies, like, for instance, you know, brain-computer interfaces and things along these lines. Either or a combination of the two could occur in our maybe, you know, not too distant future. Literally, we're looking, I think, you know, that the futurists of today have said that the time frame for the beginnings of these sorts of technologies may literally exist within the next couple of decades. As it pertains to UFOs, singularity means that when we attain such technologies and begin to change the way that human perception actually is capable of observing the reality in the universe around us that we know today, as we are made aware of levels of perception that are greater than those available to us with natural human intelligence today, I argue that a lot of UFO phenomenon that we have observed for decades already will begin to sort of see a leveling. There will be a leveling of the playing field, in other words, and that our own technology will begin to kind of become on par with some of the things we've observed in UFO phenomenon. Now, what's funny to me is that UFO phenomenon is considered something that is scientifically unjustifiable, as we've already talked about a bit, and yet there is clear, hard evidence for the existence of technologically controlled saucers and other kinds of craft that have been reported and even studied by government agencies over the last several decades. Then again, we're looking at future science, and I think that there's a lot of science that backs up the technological trends we can expect of tomorrow, but nonetheless, it is still, albeit an educated kind, it is still, in essence, speculation. We cannot prove concisely and conclusively that what we expect for tomorrow actually will be. And I think it's funny that there's that dichotomy there, because to me, the study of UFOs already brings us to a point where we have to examine this phenomenon and accept that in the more credible eyewitness reports, and I'm not talking specifically about alien abduction and things, for the time being, let's look just at unidentified flying objects in our atmosphere, flying around, doing incredible maneuvering, and utilizing an intelligence and a technology that seems to exceed what we know to exist on the conventional public level today. If that is indeed the case, we are already looking at technology that exceeds what we know to exist, and thereby the study of futurism, transhumanism, and of course technological singularity seem to be a perfect match for in terms of studying UFOs. And if we look to the past, if we look all the way back to the Second World War and even before, there are a few instances where we see what appeared to be a technology that was far greater than what we knew to exist at the time. And by looking at this past phenomenon, and by looking at the technological trends that we expect for the future, I think that we stand a good chance at not so much understanding and figuring out the UFO mystery. Rather, I think it's that the UFO mystery will be a stepping stone in reaching a greater awareness of really what our reality is and what our role is cosmologically in the universe, an entire host of things that really probably aren't even on our minds right now as a result of our limited perception of the universe.
Okay, now let me ask you this. I mean, that was a very long answer. And when I'm all said and done, I want to know, how does that differ from science fiction? I mean, 50 years ago, or even longer, there were books and stories written about submarines long before there were submarines or men walking on the moon or space travel. How does that differ? If I understand you correctly, what you're basically saying is, we're going to understand the past unexplained phenomena because science is going to overtake that or is overtaking it, and we're seeing that technology today as the technology has been developed. So how does that differ from science fiction?
That is, in essence, what I'm saying. And I do think that at times science fiction kind of points us in the right direction. It all comes down to this, really. What we have to be able to do is when we speculate about what is going on, we have to use a very, very reasonable and well-informed variety of speculation. Think about 2001, A Space Odyssey. Obviously, by the year 2001, we weren't, well, at least as we know it, we weren't utilizing space, spacefaring technologies to take us to Jupiter and beyond the infinite. But in that film, there were a lot of technologies and a lot of forecasts for how we might go about space travel in the future that we have begun to see the beginnings of. Arthur C. Clarke, correctly, I believe, predicted the creation of the telecommunications satellite, among other
right.
things.
Okay. I'm going to have to ask you to hold that thought right there, Michael. We'll pick it up when we come back. We've got a hard break coming up. Don't want the computer to shut you down. We're speaking with Mr. Micah Hanks. Excuse me, about the UFO singularity. It's a great book. His website is Graylien Report. That's GRALIEN Report, one word, .com. and you will want to check it out. If you're not already in our chat room, now's a great time to join in the conversation. Be sure to stay tuned. You won't want to miss what's coming up after a few words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Micah Hanks about his book, The UFO Singularity. And you're going to want to read this book. But before we get back to the show, I want to invite you to join me on Facebook as a friend or a fan. I post regularly everything from where I am and what's on next to the latest in science, technology, and consciousness studies. And from time to time, some of my own opinions about the world we live in. I also want to remind you to be sure and register to receive my free newsletter when you visit my site and get your free MP3. All right, let's get back to the show. Before the break, you were explaining to us, Micah, how Jules Verne, I suppose, as a great fiction writer, saw a lot of the future. Let me just ask you this. Is it possible, or do you believe that it's possible, that people from the future have traveled back in time and delivered some of this technology, and that's what we're catching up with?
There's always that potential, Eldon, but I would also argue that as opposed to just looking at things in the conventional Hollywood stereotypical interpretation of we're going to build a time machine, travel back, and change things up so that when we come back to our present, it's all hunky-dory, I would argue instead that what we're probably actually dealing with are two different kinds of phenomena, two of which may be also emanating from our future. One would be a variety of augmented intelligence in the not too distant future, or if we wanted to go ahead and just say way on down the line, sure, we could say well on down the path in the lineage of human progression and evolution, but a human in the future that would augment its intelligence, and this would thus free that individual or these beings up to being able to perceive levels quality that you or I may not be capable of perceiving. You know, think, for instance, just about how a dog or a cat can, you know, perceive aspects of the world around us that we don't. They're able to see into the infrared, and they can see in the dark, and they can sense, you know, pressure changes and barometric pressure and things like that, or even earthquakes before they happen, and in far more, real and vivid ways than you or I might. We might be able to feel a tremor in the ground just before a great earthquake hits, but, you know, a cat or a dog often will just literally lose it. They have a lot of issues, and their body reacts to physical geomagnetic changes going on. So, you know, that's a very simple explanation or example, rather, of how levels of reality that are not immediately available as information to humans, we might be able to, gain ways of interpreting reality a little differently on a perceptual level. And one other thing, too, to point out is that in the future, if humans utilize advanced technologies that allow them to change aspects of our universe, something else that could be possible, and many philosophers and physicists have looked at this as well, is the possibility that what we know as reality is in fact actually some kind of a hologram, or perhaps some sort of a digitized sort of a substructure, a matrix, if you will, kind of like the films The Matrix put forth. If reality were synthetic in some capacity, this would explain a lot of things along the lines of psychic phenomenon and other kinds of strange phenomena, and it would also be a technology that likely would be emanating from our future, and yet would not have to be a physical time traveler or a device that's equipped with the ability to travel through time, like Hollywood often puts out. And this is the point I like to drive home, is that what we see in the films and what Hollywood puts forth as being how time travel might occur is probably not exactly how it would really occur. I just don't, you know, remove the possibility that future technologies could influence our reality.
Okay, let me ask you this. And we've had Giorgio Tsoukalos on the show. And, of course, you know, he is one of Eric von Däniken's, well, he is the chosen spokesperson now for von Däniken. And you know who Tsoukalos is, right?
Of course, he was at my Paradigm Symposium that I held back in Minneapolis, Minnesota in October. I actually know Giorgio very well.
Good. Now, his position is, of course, aliens have been traveling to Earth, visiting for a long time, and he draws a lot of evidence, archaeological evidence, to support his argument. What's your view on that?
Well, I'll tell you this. My cohort, Scott Roberts, and I, prior to our Paradigm Symposium last year, we interviewed Giorgio, and I asked him about some of those kinds of things. And during that interview, I referred to Giorgio in a very complimentary way. I said, I think you're hyper-intelligent. But by the same token, I do differ from Giorgio's opinion that what must be interpreted in our ancient history as a contact with non-human intelligences was clearly actual alien extraterrestrial visitors coming down to Earth and you know, maybe even living alongside us for periods and training us in the ways of mathematics and architecture and agriculture and these sorts of things, or perhaps even genetically manipulating humans in some capacity. I differ in that I feel that in the archaeological record, we do see, you know, these paintings, portraits, cave drawings, you know, petroglyphs and things like that that appear to show human and non-human interaction, but those sorts of interactions would not have to necessarily represent physical interaction between humans and otherworldly beings. I've often wondered if that couldn't happen also maybe in a mental capacity, during an altered state of consciousness, or even perhaps during a visionary experience along the lines of those that shaman take. So there are other interpretations of how non-human intelligence might be able to influence technologies and life and existence here on Earth. I do differ from Giorgio, but I also respect his interpretation of the phenomenon as being something more real and physical and tangible.
All right. Despite the potential, then, for future connections, you also look at the technology of the past. Tell us about the 19th century airships and how these relate to your premise regarding UFOs.
Well, you know, I cite the research of an Australian researcher by the name of Andrew Nicholson, who I spoke with just yesterday, and he and I talked about that. I said, Andrew, you know, what do you think these things were? Because personally, I've always wrestled with this concept that these airships are all just instances of newspaper hoaxes. Some of the more credible instances, you know, for instance, one that actually took place around the beginning of 1897, I believe, around San Francisco in the United States. It was supposedly seen by members of the, you know, I think the police force had seen this. I think that the mayor's daughter and perhaps the mayor himself in San Francisco had actually seen this thing. And so the question arises that, you know, were all of these reports truly bunk? There were also stories that are reported about, at my website, GraylianReport.com, I did an article about this just a while back, about, you know, seen from a naval schooner, three egg-shaped red glowing craft that were seen flying through the sky. And then this was, of course, prior to World War One. What were these technologies that people were able to utilize, or I say people, but some intelligence had been able to utilize, that obviously predated known technologies here on Earth? Are we really safe in saying that we could go back before the modern innovations of aviation that were utilized during the First and, of course, more specifically, the Second World War, jet technologies and things like that, and that someone was utilizing anti-gravity or that they were utilizing advanced blimp or dirigible technologies as far back as the 1890s, and that these were the craft that were seen over cities like San Francisco? Eldon, in truth, I couldn't tell you who or what may have been behind those technologies. I just also would be very careful about saying that they were all just hoaxes and misinterpretations of natural phenomena. Now, during the beginning segment, you mentioned ball lightning in reference to the work of Charles Hoy Fort. Indeed, ball lightning and certain natural phenomena might constitute, in a few instances, what people had seen when they reported these lights in the sky that were referred to as airships, as well as some of the Foo Fighters during the Second World War. But again, I don't know that all instances can be explained away by natural phenomenon of that variety.
All right, let's jump to the most famous case, you know, Roswell, New Mexico, Area 51, that whole. Tell us about that, in your opinion.
Well, with Roswell, we have a unique instance. Obviously, the same sort of thing, the skullduggery that we see that comes about, you know, with regard to cover-ups and things in terms of UFO reports and the more credible encounters, that all sort of began with Roswell. It's initially reported that there was a flying disc captured by the military. Now, that could have been an inference made more by reporters, less by actual military officials, but when we see that the story changed the next day, they say it's a weather balloon. The story's changed decades later, and they refer to this Project Mogul. And then, of course, researchers like Stanton Friedman and so many others have come about throughout the years and dug up even more information that seemed to run not parallel, but if anything, in stark contrast to the official explanations. Eldon, my point on this, or I guess my perspective on Roswell, is that clearly something happened there. I couldn't begin to tell you if it was something extraterrestrial. And when we get into the realm of the way that conspiracy theories, misinformation, and propaganda is put out there, for direct and intentional purpose of misleading the public, it becomes very difficult for us to suppose with certainty that there were actual alien bodies recovered from the wreckage of whatever it was that came down there at Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. I mean, we could look at this from an entirely different perspective. If not aliens, what if that story were intentionally leaked to the public so as to draw attention away from a terrestrial source behind that technology? There are so many potentials, and it's so difficult, really, with the secrecy that still surrounds that incident, in terms of trying to come to a complete, full understanding of what really may have happened. But my gut tells me, as a journalist, I think something did happen. I just couldn't tell you all the details.
Yeah, I think anybody that looks into that knows there's a cover-up of something. That's an interesting perspective. Let's do this. You know, tell us about what you describe in your book as the most interesting story about UFO sightings, and that's the encounter that took place in Locust Grove, Georgia in 1973.
It's a really good one. That one is, of course, one that I guess I'm the first person to write about that, really, and it's picked up a little bit of interest since the book came out. And I also talked about that in a column in UFO Magazine either last year or the year before. And that deals with a report that was related to me by a man who I'm good friends with now. His name is Mike Reese. Mike's one of those unique characters who he's a very down-to-earth guy. He's a family man. He's a religious person. He's also a person who has some background in engineering and, you know, design, architecture, and the like. He used to read Fate magazine back in the 1960s because his father had been a subscriber, and he was well aware of, you know, what was accepted at the time as being UFO phenomena, the greater flying saucer mystery. And he told me that prior to his signing, he had always wondered what it would be like to see one. And so it was 1973, approximately 1 o'clock in the morning on a chilly November night, and he was driving along just south of Atlanta toward a little township called Locust Grove, and he'd seen a white light moving out across the North Georgia foothills. And so he drives along, misses his turnoff to get back onto the interstate, and his family asks him. He had his wife in the car with him, his sister, her two children, and I believe maybe his firstborn as well, which were all infants at the time. And his family asked him, you know, Mike, where are you going? And he said, I'm sorry, that light up there is just, it's bugging me, it's intriguing me, I want to get a better look at that. And Mike drove on, and just a little ways up the road, he actually came alongside a power substation on the left side of the road, and there hovering over it was this gunmetal gray flying saucer. It was hovering several hundred feet above the power substation in what Mike referred to as a static mode, because it wasn't moving, aside from colored lights, red, green, and blue lights that were, you know, kind of moving around and changing in sequence around the exterior of the craft, so the edges of the saucer, if you will. Mike was very intrigued by this, and his reaction to this incredible object in his presence was probably unlike most observers. He leapt out of the car. He swerved off to the side of the road in front of the substation, leapt out of the car, and started waving his arms, much to the dismay of his wife and his sister in the car, who were screaming for him, Mike, get back in the car.
Yeah.
And Mike initially told a few people about his encounter, but was ridiculed or not taken seriously, and people thought that he had maybe, you know, been tipping the eggnog a little too much, and so he became very discouraged by that and didn't talk about this encounter for close to four decades until he contacted me just a couple of years ago, explained, you know, as a listener of my weekly podcast, The Graylian Report, that's how he'd found out about me, and he wrote to me. And so I started reading Mike's account on the show, and he invited me to come have dinner, and he said, if you'd like to talk about it with those who were there who witnessed it with me, we can arrange that. And so we did. I traveled about 2 hours with a couple of fellow researchers, and we spoke with Mike for a while, and that was just the first of many meetups I've had with Mike and gotten to know him. I find Mike to be a very credible person, a very honest, a sincere person, a devoted friend as well. And he's someone who, with his background in engineering, you know, he had a brief stint in the military just as well. I believe he'd been stationed at Fort Knox. You know, Mike is the kind of person to me that is not only credible, but he has a little bit of a background that kind of supports a more discerning, even skeptical look at that kind of phenomenon. And in his own mind, he said, what I saw was not something that couldn't have existed as a result of technologies here on Earth. And when I was out standing in the chilly November night air waving my arms, all I could think was I wanted to know who was on board that thing and try and get their attention. So it was a very interesting story, and I cover that in depth in the UFO Singularity, along with a couple of similar reports.
Yeah, you tell some really interesting stories in your book, The UFO Singularity. Let me ask you this, Micah. What is the most incredible story that you have encountered having to do with UFOs that is at the same time has the kernel of credibility to it?
Well, yeah, that's a difficult question for me because I, as a researcher, have had people come to me a few times, and they'll express, they'll share their own experiences, and they will tell me in confidence things that they have seen, which I mean I wouldn't think would be anything more than maybe something that would make a good story anecdotally in a collection of stories about this sort of phenomenon, but due to the personal nature of the experience with the unexplained, when a person is confronted with an aspect that appears to be a part of our reality, and then in a waking, lucid state, a person can perceive as being some physical phenomenon, and yet it is absolutely contrary to everything that they should know to exist in this world, in this realm of consciousness. That is very troubling for many people, and as a result of that, a lot of the time that I'm when I speak with people who've had experiences, I'm only allowed to relate in confidence, you know, certain aspects of the story. So I have to tell you the very best stories that I've been told. Some of them I couldn't even relate for you here, but one good one that does come to mind. The witness merely asked for anonymity and said that, you know, if I wouldn't mention his name, I could use it in the book. It was a story that was similar to that of Mike Reese, and the reason he didn't want his name mentioned was because what he saw terrified him. But it was a large triangular craft. It was colored very similar to the object seen by Mike Reese. It was seen over Asia a few years ago, and he, of course, was a physics student and had been traveling abroad. And being a physics student, he said that this craft moved unlike anything that he thought could possibly ever exist on Earth. He said, in his opinion, this had to have been an extraterrestrial craft, and he watched it take off after he observed it for close to 2 hours. He watched it take off at such incredible speed that he said it left a streak of light that seemed to curve as though following the curvature of the Earth itself, and it frightened him so badly, he said, you know, initially he didn't want me to write about it, but later said, if you'll use a pseudonym, you know, I think that we can allow you to include that. That one comes to mind, certainly, because, again, it illustrates for us, Eldon, that there seems to be a technology here that far exceeds those things known to exist here on Earth today. And I'm not someone who's out there saying, I've got to get to the bottom of it, but I'm certainly as intrigued by it as just about anyone who would at least seek to take these sorts of things seriously, and I do take it very seriously.
Okay, now you take it seriously, but you're also skeptical, and so if I have pared down correctly your perspective, it's essentially, it's possible, but there is no hard evidence, and so I'm not going to say that it's an absolute. Have I got that right?
Well, yeah, in essence, you do. I would say this about skepticism.
So let's step from that point to this. Okay. There are lots of books, lots of experts, all dealing with alien abductions. And you must have met someone that had claims to have been abducted. How do you handle that when your perspective is there is no evidence? So, I mean, is this just somebody that is psychologically disturbed?
By no means. No. I, you know, a good friend of mine, as a matter of fact, we were on a bus and we were riding together, and he, of course, claims to be an abductee, and he described an incident that occurred to him where not only had he seen a flying saucer, but he encountered beings that he claimed were very similar to the infamous 1955 Kelly Hopkinsville case in Kentucky, where goblin-like beings were reported by a family of folks who lived in a little farm there near the little hamlet of Kelly. And these kinds of reports, high strangeness reports, alien abductions, things like that, they do come about. I think that abduction is indeed a very complex phenomenon. In some instances, I'll tell you very, very, you know, candidly that I think there is a psychological reason for the phenomenon. But I know that would trouble a lot of people, especially those who claim to have had those experiences. And so I want to be clear, I'm not suggesting that every person who has experienced an alien abduction is imagining the circumstance, but I'll give you one example of how I think that this can indeed occur. Friends of mine, Greg Newkirk and his associates from the popular Who Forted website, they had come down to North Carolina and they were doing a short segment for a documentary film they were making, and they expressed to me while we were out on a hike around Brown Mountain, a very anomalous region of western North Carolina, about how one of their team members, Jason, had actually... Again, he claimed he had never experienced anything along the lines of an alien abduction going into this, but he consented to sit down with the hypnotist. The hypnotist didn't feed any information. They basically said, all right, you see a bright light in the distance. Let's go back to that evening. Tell me what happened next. And this individual literally began to report the details of a classic stereotypical alien abduction to the point that he became so terrified and was literally having, you know, problems breathing. He was reliving an experience that he claims he knows had never taken place. But then, of course, they bring him out of the hypnosis. He says all of a sudden now that he remembers this, and he acts. He says, "I'm certain that this never happened, but the imagery that I created in my own mind was so real that I couldn't have believed. You know, if I hadn't known that I was creating this, I couldn't believe that it was anything other than memories that I'd seen." So the point I'm making here, and this is something very key to understanding what I'm trying to get across, is that in many instances, because of a popular alien abduction meme that has become prevalent in our society, people who claim to be experiencers, I'm sure, are actually sufferers of, you know, hypnotic regression that has basically been kind of supplemented as a result of that. I mean, they have a conception of what alien abduction is about, and then they claim to have these very vivid memories, which in truth may not be actual occurrences that they have experienced themselves.
Right. But that could well just be a night terror that they're revivifying during a hypnotic session.
But it does not mean in any way, though, and I do want to make this clear, Eldon, that does not mean that every person who claims to have had that experience is just a liar or that they're imagining it. I do think that there are some serious claims out there that warrant further inquiry.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And there are those that supposedly have artifacts that have been removed from them by, you know, conscientious physicians and so on and so forth. That said, like yourself, I'm open to believing the possibility, but I've yet to see the evidence that would convince me that indeed that's the case. However, you know, who am I to say? Listen, we have had a caller that's very, very patient that would like to talk to you. So I'm going to take her call, one call, because we're just about out of time. Let's go to Christian in Naples, Florida. Christian, you have been very patient, hanging on almost an entire hour. How can we help you today?
Well, I've been enjoying your whole show, and I really appreciate the information. But my question was, and I'm not familiar with Mr. Hanks, but I intend to become familiar with him, about personal interviews of people who had seen things. About the alien abductions, but because I have seen things myself that were incredible phenomenon that I knew that weren't natural, you know, that were something, it was something different than what I could fathom myself. And I just wondered if he explored those, if he, you know.
So the question, Micah, is do you follow up on personal experiences like this one that Christian is explaining?
I certainly do. That was the case with Mike Reese. He contacted me, told me about an experience he had, and people who read the UFO Singularity will actually see photographs of Mike standing in front of the power substation. For the first time in four decades after his experience, we returned to the site. It was almost surreal being able to go there, and Eldon, I kid you not, we're standing there in front of this location where he'd had this vivid encounter 40 years prior, and two dark-colored helicopters flew directly overhead. They didn't stop, they didn't linger, but they flew overhead, and we just had to chuckle about that because of the obvious conspiracy and paranoia kind of parallel there. But yeah. I certainly do follow up. I do, and if people have things that they'd like to reach out to me and share, Christian included, I can be reached on email, info@graylianreport.com, and the website is graylianreport.com.
All right. Thanks for calling, Christian. In about 30 seconds, Micah, that's about all we've got. What do you want your readers to get out of your book?
That skepticism does not have to mean that I go in with a preconception or a bias toward disbelief. I let the facts stand for themselves, and I'm just as fascinated by all this as everyone else. I hope that those who read the UFO Singularity will do so just as well.
It is a great book. I recommend the book. It is a very interesting perspective. Give your website and contact details quickly again, sir.
Again, it's www.graylianreport.com. And I'm info@graylianreport.com. If you'd like to send along a news link, we've got a podcast there available for download on the website, updated weekly. So come check us out.
Do check it out. All right, we've come to the end of another hour of Provocative Enlightenment. I want to thank the team at Hay House Radio for making what we do on this show so pleasurable. And, of course, a great big thank you to our guest and to all of you for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed our show, and we'll join us again next week, same time and same place. And if you have comments on the show, do let us know. Okay? Until next time, wherever you are in the world, remember, Believing in yourself always matters.